patience is a virtue that has to live in creative tension with passion. And with those two things, people can accomplish amazing things in their lifetime.
This is Civios, your source for public affairs research. A podcast from the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota.
Is Barbara Frey, F-R-E-Y, and my title is Senior Lecturer in the Institute for Global Studies and Director of the Human Rights Program at the University of Minnesota.
I'd like you to talk a little bit about how you came into the field of human rights. I don't think that most people, when they're 6 years old, say, I want to be a human rights advocate. So what was your evolution and how did you get to be human rights advocate?
Well, my interest in social justice issues started at a fairly young age, and it was connected to the Catholic Church and its commitment to social justice, particularly back in the 1970s, concern for civil rights in our country and for what I'll refer to human rights around the world during that time. And so I volunteered through a lot of activities through my years in Catholic education in high school, in a college. And a couple of those internships had to do with community organizing. I worked as a community organizer in Oakland, California, between my junior and senior years of college, on issues like abandoned housing and concern about rodents and trash in the neighborhood, and just learn the basic skills of as a community organizer. And then after college, I worked for a year for Oregon Fair Share in Portland, Oregon. And then I decided to go to law school back in my home state of Wisconsin. And as I was going through law school, I began to be more aware of the issue of human rights as an emerging legal field. And after law school, I decided to reconnect with the Holy Cross priests, who were my basic contacts in my other internships. And I went and lived for 6 months in Santiago, Chile, where I worked for the Catholic Church Human Rights Agency during the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. And that was a really transformative experience, much like what students get now when they go and take internships during college that really open their eyes to the kind of issues that are going on in the world. After that 6 months, I came back to a law practice in Minnesota, and I was fortunate to be able to invest myself fully in human rights because there was a brand new human rights organization that was being formed at the time.
And you were very instrumental in starting an organization here. Can you talk a little bit about that organization that you were one of the founders of?
So in the first few years of the 1980s, there was an interest nationally in the field of human rights as a place, especially where lawyers could commit themselves with their pro bono work. And there were a group of lawyers who in 1982 and 83 began to come together to create such an organization in Minnesota. And so when I started at Dorsey & Whitney Law Firm in January of 1983, I was fortunate to be able to link up with that group of lawyers who started an organization which was then called the Minnesota Lawyers International Human Rights Committee, and now is the Advocates for Human Rights. It's now has a distinguished 30-year career. I, fresh off of my experience in the internship in Chile, I was eager to be able to connect with human rights in my pro bono time, and I volunteered to be the secretary of the first board of directors and help put together the first foundation proposal that went to the Ford Foundation and got us organizational funding. So after 2.5 years at Dorsey & Whitney, the advocates then the Minnesota Lawyers Committee decided that it needed a full-time executive director, and I applied and was fortunate to have that job. So I was the director from 1985 until 1997, and that is where I learned everything by the seat of my pants and through real-life experience in human rights advocacy.
Well, before we bridge into talking about specifically the Minnesota Protocol, I'm wondering if you can give me some context and the backstory of why in the 1980s was there a hotbed? Why Minnesota? When you think of all of the places in this country where this work could have really started, what was it about Minnesota and the people that were here? You know, you have to have synergy. So can you talk a little bit about the synergy back in the 80s in Minnesota at that time?
People often ask why a state like Minnesota was the place where an international human rights organization and, in fact, a human rights community built up so quickly in the 1980s. At that time, there were a number of factors that came together to really support the idea of actually creating new institutions around human rights. The first was a concern about the wars, the conflicts being carried out in Central America that the U.S. government was supporting through arms and training that were leading to serious human rights violations in countries like Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, and Nicaragua. And there were a number of asylees who were in the Twin Cities who kind of personalized the sense of what the United States was involved with in Central America. And so lawyers were interested in representing those clients and expressing their concerns about policies that were affecting really grave human rights violations like mass disappearances, massacres, bombardments against the civilian population in those countries. There was no real outlet at that time for doing that work. And so the idea was to try to create a committee that would be based on the same idea of a nascent committee in New York called the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, and to bring together just a group of volunteers who would find and develop projects in the field of human rights. We also were really gifted to have some incredible leadership at that particular moment. One obvious asset was our mayor then, who was Don Fraser, who as congressman of the state of Minnesota had really talked about human rights and held hearings about human rights violations by U.S. allies. Even before Jimmy Carter had those words attributed to him, Don Fraser had chaired the Congressional Subcommittee on International Organizations, and he held a series of hearings and created legislation that required the State Department to document human rights violations in countries receiving U.S. aid all around the world. So Don Fraser was known throughout the world because of those hearings. He was very well known in many countries like the Philippines, South Korea, Kenya, South Africa. And so he was a natural draw for human rights leaders who were coming through the Twin Cities. And so we were able to use Don as a drawing card for those kind of leaders. The other important leaders included Professor David Weisbrot, who was already an internationally renowned human rights lawyer, who had been one of the key lawyers at Amnesty International, had helped create many important international treaties, supported people on the UN commissions and subcommissions that were doing the work. And Professor Weisbrot gave us a lot of legal guidance that was necessary for a group of energetic but unschooled volunteers at the time. And then the final person I would really highlight is a man named Sam Hinds, who is in the news these days because he's an ambassador to Norway, and he'll be leaving that post shortly with the new administration. But Sam Hinds was a young lawyer at the time, very interested in human rights, and he provided the organizational support to bring people together. So when you had a combination of interest, current events, innovative leadership, and people who could bring together important leaders in the field, that really helped bring about the Minnesota Lawyers Committee and other institutions.
You're talking about how it existed back in the 80s, that working together to create the Minnesota Protocol was easier because the conditions and the synergy was already there. So let's shift into talking about the Minnesota Protocol. How would you explain the Minnesota Protocol to a layperson?
The Minnesota Protocol is an international standard that is used to guide governments on the best practices for investigating suspicious killings or unlawful deaths. And it consists of several parts. It explains what the current international law is with regard to death investigations. And then it also has technical guidelines both for criminal investigators like police and detectives as to what's the state of the art in terms of protecting the chain of evidence, for instance. And it also has a protocol for autopsy of the body, or in the case if the body has completely disintegrated, an excavation of skeletal remains. So this document is used by governments themselves, but also by international organizations and forensic experts who want to make sure that their investigation is up to the international standard.
When I was reading about the Minnesota Protocol, the inception of it was really based on the lack of accountability in 1983 when Aquino got assassinated. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that, because that coincides with how this community here in Minnesota started to coalesce around the synergy was building. And it seems like all of this sort of came together like, well, there's no protocol here. Is that true? And if it is, can you talk a little bit about how that was the triggering event of we've got to do something? There's no accountability here. Here's this wonderful leader coming back to the Philippines and he gets assassinated, I believe, on the tarmac. Is that right? Yeah.
So the origins of the Minnesota Protocol came out of a particular political assassination in 1983 of an aspiring presidential candidate in the Philippines named Benigno Aquino, who announced that he was returning from exile to run against the president of the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos. Marcos was known for being a very strong and repressive leader. And in fact, when Benigno Aquino's plane landed on the tarmac in Manila and he walked off the plane, he was literally assassinated right then and there. And there was a great international outcry about this assassination. And in response, the president of the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos, said that there would be a complete and full investigation. And that brought on a lot of cynical responses because the question is, how will we know if something is a complete investigation? There's really no international standard that suggests what a state should do when there's a suspicious, unlawful killing. A list of first projects or project ideas was sent to this aspiring group of lawyers by Professor Weisbrod, who at that time was on sabbatical at Amnesty International. And it had many good ideas on the list, and some of them did develop into projects. And the one that is best known is the development of a protocol for what constitutes an adequate investigation in when there's a potentially unlawful death. And that project led people from the county attorney's office, led at that time by Hennepin County Attorney Tom Johnson, and people from the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office, led at that time by Gary Peterson, to take a look at what Minnesota standards are for if you come across a dead body on the street. What is the protocol for the police and for the medical examiners to follow to determine what is the manner of death? And those basic first pieces of research began to evolve. They were sent to Amnesty International, which began to discuss them. And the suggestion was that they be written up in a more generalizable way that could be used or suggested as a standard for good practice in investigating suspicious deaths. That was the initial project. We had a group of willing volunteers. We had young medical investigator, medical examiner Lindsay Thomas, who took this on as a volunteer project when she was fresh out of medical school. We had a group of young law clerks who worked in the Minnesota Lawyers Committee's office who started looking into police protocol, and we came up with an initial draft. And so we were off.
What were your guiding principles, and how did you work across these different agencies amidst all of this passion and sometimes outrage and very heady stuff in those days? How did you work across that? That seems very interesting to me.
So the guiding principle of the Minnesota Lawyers Committee, which is retained to this day in the mature organization that is the Advocates for Human Rights, is that we organize volunteers to do work. And initially it was a lawyers committee, so it was primarily lawyers, though we involved many doctors on the protocol. And we knew, well, we built off of the notion of pro bono work, and that working on international human rights was a form of pro bono work. Now, we had some early volunteers who were very eager to work on these projects, but we also did a lot of recruiting. We spent a lot of the early years of the organization giving talks in law firms, lunch talks. We'd invite young associates to come talk about the human rights issues of the day, and then we'd ask them to sign up as volunteers. They'd end up on a list, which was then a mailing list and not an email list at the time, and we would invite them to the next events. And we would have conversations about what were the issues that they were interested in, what they like to do, would they like to represent clients or do research. So in the case of the Minnesota Protocol, we needed a particularized type of expertise on some parts of the protocol, specifically the autopsy protocol.
So can you talk a little bit about the Minnesota Protocol actually being at the intersection of law, international law, and forensic science?
So in order to do an adequate investigation of a death, we need to think about standards in a few different ways. First, there are legal standards that have to do with what are the obligations of states. Then there are more technical standards, like the forensic investigation that is at the heart of a typical criminal investigation. And so we were really lucky to be able to pull in a community of forensic doctors from the start, both in our local community, but also through the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, and through an international forensic working group made up of professors and professionals from around Europe and Latin America. And the result was that we had literal sections in the protocol. So there was a section on the current standards of international law. There was a brief section on how to carry out crime scene investigation. And then the part that was originally called the Minnesota Protocol was the Autopsy Protocol, which is a very extended and well-regarded technical explanation of what are the steps and what is the sequence of the steps that medical examiners should use and even untrained medical examiners should use to determine the cause and manner of the death.
So you developed the protocol, and then in order for it to actually realize its potential, it needed to be adopted by the UN. And what was that process like? Can you talk a little bit about how that came to happen?
So after about a year and a half of work of developing the pieces of the protocol, we had gathered a number of international experts and diplomats who were interested in this process. A big part of my work on the process was actually trying to raise money to hold an international conference in Minnesota where we would bring together all these experts and be able to sew together all the pieces. That was a much more complicated task than you can imagine, because local funders had no understanding of why they should fund a project that didn't seem to have importance in Minnesota, because we already had legal standards. And international funders didn't really know who this small group of Minnesota lawyers were who were trying to promote this effort. Ultimately, it was the government of Denmark that contributed $10,000. And with that $10,000, we were able to hold a three-day conference at Spring Hill Conference Center in 1987, where we brought together UN special procedures, the special rapporteur on extrajudicial killings, and his staff person, staff people from the UN's conference in Vienna on crime prevention and control, forensic doctors, forensic anthropologists. It was quite an astounding meeting and very productive. The result of that meeting were two documents. One is called the Principles on the Effective Investigation and Prevention of Extrajudicial Summary or Arbitrary Killings. That two-page document of principles was ultimately adopted by the General Assembly and the UN. It went through the Crime Prevention and Control branch of the UN up through the standard-making process there and was given the imprimatur of the General Assembly in 1989. In the protocol itself, actually serves as an explanatory set of guidelines for those principles. So the thing that has the force of soft law at the international level are the principles. The Minnesota Protocol is an interpretation of what the experts have to do on the ground in order to comply with those principles.
So let's talk a little bit now about some specific investigations, if we can, just to provide context, like how is this applied? So if you can tell some stories, like how was it used in Rwanda, for instance? I mean, it's based on the premise that a government is actually going to respect and take care of its citizens. But when it doesn't, and they unearth a mass grave, how does the Minnesota Protocol get initiated?
The UN principles and the Minnesota Protocol are brought into action in cases where there is a high-profile death or disappearance, or say there's a massacre, or there's a big group of disappearances like there were recently in the state of Mexico when 43 students were disappeared. And it's brought into play in two ways. One is that the international NGO community of human rights will call upon the government through international mechanisms to carry out an investigation in accordance with the principles. And then any experts who are called in, whether they're forensic pathologists or lawyers doing criminal investigation or the international police if they're doing a crime scene investigation on a high-profile crime, they are aware of and will follow the guidelines in the section of the Minnesota Protocol that applies to their work. So we know that, for instance, the Argentine forensic group of Argentine forensic anthropologists who work globally on investigations of mass killings and skeletal remains are well-schooled in the kind of principles that are in the Minnesota Protocol. There has been, of course, a lot of sophisticated technical developments in the field of forensic investigation, like DNA matching. That was one of the reasons that we needed to update the Minnesota Protocol recently. There have also been important crime scene investigations in places, especially where international ad hoc tribunals or the International Criminal Court are bringing cases, like investigations in Rwanda or in Uganda against the Lord's Resistance Army, where if there is a crime scene to be had, that it's not only the forensic doctors who do the examining, but the criminal investigators understand how to secure a site and how to manage evidence so that it is not corrupted, how to investigate it through personal witnesses, the use of photography, the use of other kinds of physical and ballistic evidence. So all of these are the kinds of steps and standards that are included and have been updated in a really powerful way in the newest version of the Minnesota Protocol for use in either by local police or by the international community if it's doing the investigating.
Can you talk about how the Minnesota Protocol in a past investigation that most people weren't aware that it was because of the Minnesota Protocol that this was the effect? This evidence was gathered and the charges were this?
Recently, the past president of Guatemala, General Rios Montt, was tried and convicted of genocide in Guatemala. And in covering that case, it became known that the forensic doctors who were investigating the graves and the deaths of the many indigenous people of the Mayan community who were killed by the death squads in Guatemala, that those investigators used the Minnesota Protocol as a way to put together proof that was used in the trial against General Rios Montt. We are really delighted to hear of that use of the Minnesota Protocol. We know that the principles in the protocol are used and transmitted by UN agencies and civil society organizations to states where investigations are going on. But that Guatemala case, which has been so important in both Guatemala's history and the recognition of the genocidal acts that were carried out against the Mayan people, but also has reinvigorated really a search for evidence of other genocides that took place during that time period in Central America and other states. So we're really pleased to know that the protocol was helpful in that investigation.
So when you were talking earlier about the Minnesota Protocol, there's going to be an update. Can you talk a little bit about why we needed to do this and what are some of the changes that we can expect to see?
The Minnesota Protocol was published by the UN in 1991. And for many years after that, the UN Commission on Human Rights asked the international community and the Minnesota Lawyers Committee to create a revised version to include updates in the laws, updates in forensic procedures and in crime scene procedures. And it wasn't until 2014 that the international community really had the wherewithal to come together and undertake that kind of revision. The revision was spearheaded by the UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Killings, who just finished his term in 2016. His name was Christoph Haynes, and he's a South African law professor. And he took it as part of his mandate as a special procedure of the UN to bring together a new global network of experts on law, crime scenes, and forensic investigations to update the protocol. And most of the work was done in 2014, and then the revised protocol has been sent around to states for comments. They've received comments from states, and the new revision will be released in 2017. It's now called not just casually but formally the Minnesota Protocol on the Investigation of Potentially Unlawful Deaths. Minnesota Protocol used to be a nickname for the document, but because it came to be associated with that name, the drafting committee thought that it was appropriate to brand the document as the Minnesota Protocol. And this revised set of laws and standards and guidelines will guide the next generation of human rights activists, of forensic doctors, and of states themselves who want to carry out adequate death investigations.
I'm wondering if you can talk about why is it important for people in the state of Minnesota to care about this? Now, it's different for you. You know, you've spent the majority of your life drilling down into this whole area of international law, and, you know, your passion has driven you down this trajectory. But why is it important for people in Minnesota? What do they need to know about this?
There's a lot of pride around the Minnesota Protocol among a group of advocates, and of certainly the people who've been involved in the project from the start. Our representatives and senators in Congress have been really helpful in making sure that the United States government was supportive of the revision. The people who work in medical examiner's offices and at the BCA are aware of the protocol and have had individuals who'd been involved in the process. But beyond this group of experts and policymakers, it's really important for the people of Minnesota to understand this kind of project for two reasons. First, I think, is to understand that Minnesota is one of the most important sites of human rights law and policy in the world. We're one of the top cities in the world for human rights professionals. We have wonderful institutions in addition to the Advocates for Human Rights, the Center for Victims of Torture, Global Rights for Women, the Nonviolent Peace Force was created here. Minnesota has an international reputation for generating innovative approaches to protect the rights and dignity of people, not just in Minnesota, but around the world. And one of the reasons we can obviously do this is because we ourselves have become accustomed to a pretty high level of expertise in the rule of law and genuinely fair processes. We have our problems in Minnesota occasionally, but for the most part, the legal community, the prosecutor's offices, the defense lawyers, the judges are all very professional people who work hard to be fair and transparent in the way that they carry out their work as public officials. And that brings us to the second reason that this is important. Minnesota is a state that has a high standard of the rule of law, but we want to keep it that way. And so we want to make sure that in the future, no matter who are our elected officials or who are in the offices that carry out the public business of investigation and prosecution or the police, that we hold ourselves to the same standards of high practice in investigating suspicious or controversial killings. We had a couple controversial killings in the past 2 years in the state of Minnesota. In Minneapolis, the killing of Jamar Clark by two Minneapolis police officers and the killing of Philando Castile in Falcon Heights by a police officer in that district. And those cases investigated in tremendous detail by the prosecutor of Hennepin County and the prosecutor of St. Paul, Ramsey County, needed to meet this level of high standard and this level of transparency in order for the public to have faith that they came to the right decision in an unbiased and fair manner.
Can you talk a little bit, when you think about this work that you've done and working alongside others to develop the Minnesota Protocol, can you talk a little bit about some of the lessons learned? I mean, it's like 30 years of hard work. And in the beginning, you were, you know, a young upstart, full of passion. And some of this work can be really a slog and pushback. What are some of the lessons learned in working something like this?
I believe that no matter what our professional objectives in a field like human rights, so for some people, they work to establish standards and implement them in areas of personal interest like women's human rights or the rights of GLBT persons or on behalf of people of their particular ethnicity. In all of these cases, I think that people need to understand that there is a long-term goal and then there are short-term goals in order to get there. One way to think of it is that the use of these international standards might not fully take place until after my lifetime, but that doesn't diminish the importance of taking steps towards the establishment of those standards and ultimately the professional implementation of those standards. We often use the image of a mountaintop in talking about human rights advocacy, where if we're creating a campaign around a human rights issue, we know we want to get to that mountaintop where extrajudicial killings are prevented, and we believe that one of the steps along the way it will be to make sure that all people who carry out extrajudicial killings or arbitrary killings are investigated and prosecuted for their crimes, and that that will create a deterrent effect that will reduce the number of extrajudicial killings. That mountaintop is not one that we're going to reach in a short period of time. So we have to plan a path to get to the mountaintop. And there are several stops along the way, and then there are unexpected things that happen where we might get bumped backwards for a period of time and lose our footing and have to plan a different route to get to the mountaintop. But that doesn't mean that that goal of the mountaintop, even if we don't reach it in our professional lifetime, is not worth taking on. And this is one of those projects where I have seen not just the idea come into fruition in its first form in the late 80s of a set of standards and ideas that were concretized into a guidebook that we hoped would be used to prevent international killings or all sorts of arbitrary killings, but that we saw that those actual guidelines be used. We saw them used in prosecuting human rights cases. And then we realized that those standards could be improved. and then bringing together people way outside of the circle of initial drafters to bring their international experience and make these standards even better. And now we're in the phase of relaunching these kind of standards that will move us up that mountaintop, move us up that mountainside towards an ultimate goal of more fair, transparent, and competent investigations that ultimately will reduce the number of disappearances and deaths among people around the world.
When we talked in your office about doing this podcast, it was right after the election. And you've had good fortune in your life to be able to have a career that allows you to extend your passion into your work world, into your, you have a way to do, you have a path to react. It's coming from the metaphor of the mountaintop. There's many summits. We'll get to one summit, and then we'll see that we've got more work to do. Can you give some advice for people when they feel helpless? How do you turn that helplessness into action?
When I was a young human rights advocate, I used to get extremely frustrated sitting at meetings at the United Nations and watching the wheels of justice in an area that I felt very deeply about move so slowly. It felt to me like watching the paint dry, and I really wanted to bring about change in a much more rapid manner. Since that time, I've had the benefit of watching standards that were just ideas in people's heads turn into fruition and be utilized in the field. This experience has given me a patience for the long view that I didn't have when I was a young advocate. I think we need that impatience as young advocates when we're seeing people be harmed on a day-to-day basis. I would not preach patience to every person or allowing systems to take too much time to bring about justice. But one thing that I have also seen is that people who are really committed to ideas, especially ideas of justice, they don't give up. In the face of adversity, they keep on fighting and keep on fighting, and it becomes a life mission. So when the victims of genocide of the Khmer Rouge, which took place in the late 1970s, didn't get a trial or a truth commission until the UN finally established a hybrid international criminal court for Cambodia in the late 1990s and early 2000s, and the first trials weren't held until the decade of the 2010s. You're thinking about people against whom harm was done 40 years prior, and yet people came to those trials and they sat and they listened to the accused perpetrators have to answer questions about what their motivations were and what they did. They never really gave up. We've seen this time and time again in countries all around the world that families of victims never give up in the search for justice, and neither should we. Doesn't matter how long it takes, that if we have a goal that we're fighting for and we don't see that goal fully implemented, it means we need to keep moving to the next step. If we get knocked back flat, as we did during the George W. Bush era of torture in Guantanamo and other U.S. sites, we pick up the pieces, we put together our arguments, we go back to the public and explain why torture is morally wrong, why the U.S. should not do it because it will harm U.S. soldiers and military as much as it will, and it will be ineffective in the long run. Whenever there are people who want to bring back really terrible ideas like segregating immigrants, Muslims, and people on the basis of their beliefs, then I think we remind people based on our historical experience and our very real understanding as to why those are terrible ideas and how it will end up harming us. Patience is a virtue that has to live in creative tension with passion. And with those two things, people can accomplish amazing things in their lifetime. And you see it from individuals who committed themselves to one particular cause, and they may not have even seen that cause happen in their lifetime. We think of Martin Luther King. I think of Raphael Lemkin, who created the Genocide Convention, but didn't really live to see it implemented through the International Criminal Court system. There's a lot of these big ideas that are way bigger than one person, one group, one individual lifetime that are going to take a lot of years. But we need to show up and we need to continue to advocate for those goals, or no one will ever get to the mountaintop, much less ourselves.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Civios, an initiative of the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. To learn more about this segment, please visit civios.umn.edu.